Hi, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Lab Talks. I am Ben Putley. I am the CEO and co-founder of Alchemy, and it's my absolute pleasure today to be joined by Harry Horsfall. Harry, introduce yourself to us.
Awesome. Ben, thank you so much for having me. I'm Harry Horsfall. I'm the CEO and co-founder of Flight 3. I'm the community manager of Zebu Live. I've obviously been following the podcast. Amazing to see some of the guests that you've had on. Nice mix of people, and I'm really glad to be here. And I've been lucky or unlucky enough to be in Web3 for, you know, 10 plus years as an advocate, investor, advisor. And, you know, my early background was in music festivals, which was my first business, which I sold. Sadly or happily, it's quite nice. I was like, I'm never running events again. And, you know, getting into Bitcoin pretty early and running as the music festival grew and scaled, I then sort of like started running other events to support it. And I ran a Bitcoin event in 2013.
Okay, nice. Didn't know that.
That was really a penny drop moment. And, and now we're building Flight 3, which is a marketing agency.
Cool. So what kind of marketing do you do at Flight 3?
So the type of marketing we do is super varied.
Yeah.
Very similar to sort of Web3. But no, really practicing on like sort of go to market, product launches. More and more we do a lot of like UK community building. A big part of the Super Team UK, which is Solana's sort of localized community, and it's amazing to see that grow both in Germany and the UK. And of course now we're working with Coinbase and Google as well, which is sort of, so it's a really weird mix, but predominantly Web3 focused business.
Okay, cool. So I guess there's a lot of, you need a lot of specific knowledge to tell other people about how to market in Web3. Like, how did you initially discover Bitcoin? You said it was a while ago now. So like, what was the journey? How did you do it?
Yeah, so the journey was, I didn't really know what Bitcoin was. My friend told it. I was messing around in 2011 at uni. I wish I still had that wallet. And so I kind of found my way to it, where, you know, using really complicated escrow, you know, bank transfer, Bitcoin's held in escrow, finally get it. Anyway, I studied economics and politics.
Okay, yeah.
So I love the concept of self-sovereignty. I like economics. And around this event in 2013, and I booked a guy called Paul Gordon, who was he ran the original Bitcoin meetup. And when he explained to me what this thing that I'd already used and didn't have to quite grasp what it was, I was like, wow, this is the future. This is it. And I remember I was at a dinner party where my mum used to be head of marketing at the BBC, and I was telling everyone, just sell their house and buy it. And they're like, can we get this guy a straitjacket, please? And then of course Mt. Gox happened in 2014, and I was like, right, I'm done with that. Went into sort of Paddy Power Betfair, which is a very good way to learn marketing, because it's not if I spend 60 million and you spend 40 million, 60, 40 split. It's very, very aggressive market. At the end of the day, I don't care whether I use Paddy Power, Betfair, or Bet365. I just want to bet on Arsenal winning the league, etc. So really, really good way to learn marketing. Then went on to like lots of various different startups, and then 2016, the sort of Bitcoin price came back to the price that, you know, $1,000 at the halving, and I was like, oh my god, I still got my wallet. Found it out, and I was like, right, this time it is the future. I'm not gonna like lose that belief. So I was like, I was running an event with Brett Hobbiton, who made lastminute.com, called Founders Forum, and in walks Nick, who's the chairman of blockchain.com. And I was like, Nick, you're the guy that I've been waiting for. I would do any role at blockchain.com. And he was like, please, can I meet you for coffee anyway? I badgered him three times. He says, fine, I'll meet you for the coffee. They were just doing a $400 million raise. And he was like, listen, the only people we need right now are devs and devs and devs. And so it took me about a year. And then finally I found a company called Luno, which is sort of the Coinbase of South Africa. And I saw an article in the paper on the news aggregator being like, Luno's the fastest growing company in Europe. So I was called them up and I was like, let me work for you. And they're like, really? Because every other time they were doing a big recruitment and they were paying big money to get all the, like, try and convince the Facebook type people to join. And they're like, you actually went, and you know, that was an amazing journey. I joined when we were about 30 people. And when I left, there was 1,000.
Holy shit, okay.
And we went from 900,000 users to 10 million. It was actually quite a tough start, because when we started marketing, it was the end of the bull run.
Yeah, okay.
So before that, when everyone had like manual KYC, the whole office had to like stay up all night and go through all the KYCs. Mm. And then suddenly we started marketing and users went down because it was quite a retail platform and retailers just didn't want thing. So it was really, really exciting. And they obviously sold to DCG, which is run by Barry Silbert. So like big, big group. Mm-hmm. I'm watching that grow. And I think it was in the COVID pandemic because I sat next to the CEO and the COO and I lived and breathed it. And and because we were in the London office, but as the company grew, I realized that actually I was quite far away from the decision-making. So that's when I was like, right, we're going to make, it was DeFi summer.
Yeah.
Made our own token. Mm-hmm. Well, it was a wild ride. And then to answer your question, that's kind of, obviously I have been working, I love marketing as well. I'm very, very passionate about telling good stories and cutting through noise. And then obviously working marketing in exchange, which is quite a difficult thing, similar to, you know, whether you use Coinbase, Binance, crypto.com, you don't really care.
Yeah.
Do they have a good spread? Do they have a good selection of coins? Yeah. Great.
Yeah.
Coinbase works. I'm going to use Coinbase.
Yeah.
And so that's when my brother came up with the sort of wisdom of the crowd, and we launched in, no idea what we're doing, launched a token right in the mania. And that's kind of how I learned to do it. We had another go, and then out of that, I realized the tech was actually really challenging.
Yeah.
We had outsourced devs, very, very expensive. I think if you want to talk to me about marketing, I could talk to you about it all day, and I know how long things take. Mm. I think the technical side, especially, you have to remember in 2020, Solidity devs were like,
gold dust.
You know, an average Solidity dev was 15, 16, 17,000 a month, and they probably had four jobs. So if you didn't understand the technology, that made us pivot without even really realizing it into making ZeBu Digital.
Yeah.
And ZeBu means always bullish, zero bullshit.
Yeah.
And you know, as we were all of the things that we'd experienced building our own coins, we were like, wow, we could do this to a professional level to help other people launch their coins. And you know, that bull run was an amazing journey as we went up. But then, of course, the bear hit, and I think that taught us even more about marketing in a bear market. You have to be very price conscious. You know, a Cointelegraph article shared by a KOL is not going to move a price.
No, yeah.
Whereas as we move back into pandemonia. So that's kind of the journey. And I think, you know, I always say to anyone, you know, anyone that says they're like a crypto marketing expert is kind of a bit of a buzzword. We're still like figuring out what's working.
I agree. I think it's, as someone that has spent a lot of time in the kind of web two. I don't necessarily even call it marketing. I just call it advertising. I think it's slightly different. I couldn't quite tell you on a piece of paper why those two things are different. But what blockchain companies tend to do is it's either a lot of like DR performance-based marketing. So like KOLs and tweets and reach and it getting a following up, whatever it may be. Or if you've done really well, you sponsor a football team. Or a Formula One team. You know, there's nowhere in between really that's done that well. And I think that is where, in my mind, Web 3, if you want to call it that, can learn a lot from Web 2. And that's what we're trying to do at Alchemy, is like, okay, there's so much you can do in between on channels where there's loads of eyeballs with some nice attribution. And there like needs to be this kind of like coming of age of blockchain companies to like not be down here, not be us up here, kind of like everywhere in between. Because people still don't do that.
Yeah, and a lot of that reason is, I remember in 2018, so we were spending $300,000, $400,000, $500K on Google.
Yeah.
We got the letter through from Google. We'd optimized it quite well. We're getting, you know, $19, $20 CPAs.
Yeah.
And Google are like, you know, blockchain is, Bitcoin is bad.
Yeah,
we're shutting you down. And I remember my CMO at the time was like, let's go everything we can before they shut us down. And you know, I think today, like when we see the big names, you know, the BlackRocks and all of those mega US regulated companies literally making ETFs on Wall Street, you forget like 2017, 2018, every single day we were being sent India bans Bitcoin, China bans Bitcoin. And so as a result, as marketeers, that meant there were a lot of bad actors doing phishing scams and all of this stuff. And rug pulls. And so as a result, we were banned from, you know, the platforms you were saying. And then the second point is if I'm looking for, let's say I'm working on a Solana project and it's a DEX that's improving on Uniswap, it's got low, you know, high liquidity, good features, et cetera, et cetera. Me just randomly putting that advert out to the masses.
Doesn't make sense.
It's a very, very niche journey of like, have they got a Coinbase wallet? Yes, no. Have they learned about Bitcoin? Have they learned about Ethereum? And when I see the Super Bowl now, you know, the whole point of my first 4 years in crypto, my marketing role was education.
Yeah.
I had to be like, Bitcoin is this, it's digital gold. You know, I made hundreds of those videos.
Yeah.
This is what Bitcoin's, you know, but like, so I had to educate people. This is what Bitcoin is. This is what a Bitcoin wallet is.
Yeah.
This is why we're safe and trustworthy, et cetera, et cetera. You know, not your keys, not your crypto. You shouldn't leave your crypto on an exchange, but you know, some of these exchanges are getting better. But now when we look at the Super Bowl, you know, the Binance, Coinbase, crypto.com ads, even OKX, they're going much more into lifestyle and brand, and you know, they're not explaining this is what Bitcoin is, this is why you need it. They're like, these are our features, and here's our, you know, they've got what's it called, Lando Norris and Max Verstappen in it. And you know, the big, to your previous point, the big problem that we have as an agency is that if we're marketing a product that's just doing a whitelist and then wants to launch, it's quite hard to build your, obviously we do build a funnel and like work out the value of each customer through the phase. But in normal marketing, or at Luno, we wanted to get people to sign up, pass KYC, do their deposit, and then the magic for us was when they did their third trade.
Right, okay.
And sometimes the actions that we're trying to create when we're like, let's say projects say we want 100,000 Twitter followers, and I'm thinking, I mean, we could do 4 giveaway competitions and give $10 per person who likes retweets and you can get that. But like, that's a very weak metric.
Yeah.
And you know, I know you're an advertising expert and I'm sure you're really good at looking at how did your videos perform? Like, are you getting good CPM, whatever it is? And I think maybe our goals haven't been quite clear enough to need that drive through. So that middle of the funnel is an interesting thing. And I think deep down, we don't really care about blockchain technology as an everyday consumer. We want, you know, I don't care that my Google Meet is hosted by AWS.
Yeah.
I'm just really grateful I don't have to fly to Spain to meet our ops manager who's based in Spain. And it's like, I still think maybe we're missing that breakthrough product that, you know,
I agree.
We were chatting before, you know, like just today, Sony just announced their big L2 plans. Mm-hmm. Samsung have come out with their big plans.
Yeah.
They're not suddenly a Web3 company, are they? They're still the biggest entertainment and phone companies.
Mm-hmm. So I've had a lot of these conversations recently, and there's this like notion of like a Web3 brand, which sure is true. Like if you have like a specific Web3 product, then you are arguably a Web3 brand. But when you think about brands over history, they're not defined by the technology they use. Like Apple, for example, builds all their own stuff, but they're not defined by the chips they use. It's like the way it makes you feel, and then the channels they've used successfully. It's like, it sounds really wanky, but it's like a feeling that you get when you associate yourself to a particular brand. It's like some people love Nike, other people love Adidas. They're basically selling the same thing. The brands just stand for something slightly different. And like fundamentally, that's a slightly different way of thinking about it, is it doesn't matter what the underlying technology is, so long as the technology that's used gives you that feeling that you associate with that brand. You know, like that is something that I still think blockchain is stuck in a little bit, because you're like, oh, how did you swap that crypto? It's like, oh, I use Radium or Jupiter or Uniswap or Farmer Trader Joe, whatever it is. It's like, who cares? You know, it's like whenever I go buy something in a shop, no one's ever asked me, how did you buy that?
Yeah.
It's like, I went to it and got it. Do you know what I mean? Or I just got it off a website. It's not like I used Apple Pay actually, or I used my Monzo or my MasterCard. It's just like, I did the thing with the technology that happened underneath. It didn't really matter.
Yeah. And I think if you look at, I spent a lot of time in South Africa.
Yeah.
You know, the rand at the moment, it's like every time I go to South Africa once or twice a year, and every time I go back, beer is getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper.
Nice.
And, you know, Bitcoin and what Luno was offering at that time was a really, really good solution to get global payment, store it securely in your own, with, you know, a smartphone, without having to integrate with a bank, because a lot of them are underbanked. And I think sometimes in London, that, you know, the problem that Luno had is if they acquired a user in London and then they bought $50 of Bitcoin, that was the end of the journey. That was like the end of the journey. And I think if we look at someone like Revolut, you know, Revolut have very, very quietly, very, very efficiently made crypto one of their biggest offering.
Totally. Yeah. I think they're one of the top 20 wallets of Bitcoin holders. I was looking at the Bitcoin rich list the other day and Revolut were up there, which I thought was quite surprising.
Yeah. And it's, you know, you can get your insurance, you can get your product. You know, like I say, it's very easy to forget how far we've come.
Yeah, it's true.
That, like, you know, the days of me like getting cornered, being like, "You're an idiot," you know, this is all a scam, is kind of dying down. And you know, the cool thing for our industry is the early adopters have, you know, when we look at the NFT craze, you know, I was heavily involved in that. I'm still holding a lot, unfortunately.
Same.
But you know, we always knew it was silly. Like, we're trading JPEGs that do nothing. Some of them will be blue chips, a bit like we look at Pokemon cards, they've come back. Everyone still wants a punk.
Yeah.
I'd love a punk,
you know,
even though it's ridiculous. But people just printing thousands of NFTs quickly was almost like us just like practicing how this can work.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I think that the only way you can see how your smart contract works or your marketing strategy for your 10,000 PFP collection is to do it. And I think that was, some people did it with bad intentions, other people did it with good intentions, like, I've got a doodle, I've had it forever, you know, like, it's, they are one of the NFT brands which I think will survive. They've got, like, Pharrell Williams as a creative director, the artwork's really cool, they've created a bunch of derivative collections, which kind of still makes me think they're trying to find their way and what exactly it is that they do, but fundamentally they just created a brand that's associated to some cool artwork, and that is really the magic of it, you know.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Doodles. My friend's company was actually bought by he makes music for all the Doodles, and you know, they basically want to change IP, don't they, and how they're going to connect that. And so I think all of these phases that we go through that look really, really stupid. Even SBF, you know, like, the guy was a really, really bad actor.
Yeah.
And and he did really well in terms of amount of capital he had under his wing. And, you know, they're giving back all the money. They now have 16 billion.
Yeah.
Unfortunately for the people that had their Bitcoin in there, they've sold it and turned it to cash and they're getting dollars back at a $19,000 valuation and at 60. So that's pretty frustrating for them. But yes, he was using QuickBooks to run a $10 billion company. Mm-hmm. But looking back, we didn't have access to accountants. We didn't have access to lawyers. I still remember when I went to my lawyer, very senior guy, and the intern was brought in to sort of translate. So I think we need these brands to be built. You know, I really love what Coinbase have done here, in the sense of they haven't taken shortcuts. They've worked through it. And they are a really blue chip business that would fit in. And I think maybe in the more sort of startup phase, everyone has not had rules and regulations to follow. And, you know, we suffer with that a lot in the UK is that, you know, and in America, like, the UK is actually crypto curious. Mm. You know, I spend a lot of time talking to the ministers. They're like, you know, I was talking to the lady who's in charge of Dover, and she's like, if we can speed up imports and exports by 10%, we can make 1% to GDP.
Really?
You know, you know, so using blockchain technology to quickly check everything coming in. Yeah. But she's like, I don't know how that works. I don't know how to start. Mm. So people are now excited to sort of test it out. I think a lot of big brand people, you know, 2 years ago, all the big brands were pinging us and being like, we want to do an NFT collection, especially football clubs. Mm. And they all were basically, they were doing it with the wrong motive. They were doing it as cash grabs.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, Tezos do a good job with Man U, and they've got a quite cool partnership. You know, they've given away all the NFTs for free. They made gaming cards. Like, if me and you are like meeting around a pub and we've got an idea for, I don't know, some NFT set, we need the 5 million to build it. Someone like Man U, their fan base globally is insane. You know, when you're in Cape Town and it's the football, everyone's in full kits, you know. And so actually, how do they use digital collectibles to bring them closer and rather than just try and squeeze more money out of them?
And I agree.
And I think maybe big brands we'll have another stab at it, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I think luxury brands are creating like an NFT accompaniment to a particular item so you can't, so you know it's real.
Yeah.
So just like provenance.
Provenance, yeah.
There you go, boom, found it.
Rare wine.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, that's a nice, like an immutable record is a really nice way to prove something is what it is, you know? Yeah. Like, and it's at the moment, if you buy a watch, it's like the box and papers comes with it. But that, like, if you lose that, that has like a detrimental effect on the value of the watch. It's like, why not that just be on chain and then you solve that problem forever? So long as the numbers match the numbers, like it's problem solved, really. And I think I want to go back to your SBF because I read that book that Michael Lewis wrote when he's got a bit of a habit of being in the room where shit's about to happen, which has like been really profitable for him as an author, but also gives other people an insight into what was going on. I read that book in like 2 days because there's not many Web3 founders around. So like you don't really get to meet peers and like chew the fat on it. I think it's why we get on so well, is because you're also a Web3 founder. We can like uniquely share experiences that are hard to come by. And yeah, I wanted to ask you, like, what do you think is like the thing that you've learned, I guess, the hard way and the easy way from being a Web3 founder?
Yeah, I think being a Web3 founder is like, it's like being a founder on steroids. If we look at Uber,
yeah,
you know, one of my favorite apps, I use it all over the world, but they've had their problems. Mm. With drivers, with individual actors under their whatever, but they went public 11 years after, you know, they raised 500k from whoever they raised it, you know, whatever, and they've raised all this money and they've had all of the, and they went public 11 years later.
Yeah.
When we look at Web3 founders, within 6 months sometimes they've gone from idea to being publicly traded.
That's weird.
We all know how long tech takes and how you know, me, especially me, I'm a consumer marketeer. You know, I talk to people and I realize our theory was wrong. Mm. We got to pivot like this. Mm-hmm. Each pit, you know, to try and find that product market fit.
Yeah.
And you're a Web3 founder. You've either raised money from the crowd or pretty makeshift VCs, you know, like they are VCs, but like they are not an A16Z, they've also made some money in Web3 and they're putting it back in and they're great and they fueled it. But suddenly you are 6 months into your project. You've had a great idea.
Yeah.
And then you have a 10,000 person community, global community that don't all speak English natively. So can come across, quite direct and maybe aggressive, but they're not actually being aggressive. It's just the translation.
Totally agree.
Of combined with the fact that everyone's online 24/7 because it's global. And not, like, you know, one of my co-founders lived in Australia and it's like, we don't care that it's 4 a.m. in the morning. Mm. We're moving, right? You know, in a different industry, you'd be like, whoa, you're up in 4 a.m. Yeah. Thank you so much. It's like, in Web3, it's like, well, you're in Web3 and we need to get this done. So it's your fault for living in Australia. Like the sympathy is not there.
Yeah.
It's the pressure of building in public from such an early stage.
Totally agree.
The pressure of in like some days I look like a good marketer and I'm not that good a marketer. The market's just ripping.
Yeah,
you know. But of course, the other thing happens when I've worked on a campaign for 12 months, and you know the way marketing works is, may look like you're not doing anything, but we're doing all the networking, all the planning, all the thing, and then we're ready to launch, and then that day, zoom, the whole market's done. So I think the external pressures that we can't control, also like things like regulation, you know, all of these new things that are coming and can be quite intimidating if you're not used to looking at all of that stuff. And then I think the positive thing is that if you call up any Web3 founder who's about your tier, obviously, if you call up the head of Polygon or the head of Cardano, he's going to be like, yeah, who are you?
Yeah, yeah.
Put the phone down. But because we're all in this space together, we really are trying to help each other. And build together. And I think that's an added bonus because I don't believe that we're competing with each other yet.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, we are still like, wow, I help you, I'll share my code. And I do think building that network, and it's why I love events so much, and actually spending time with people when they're not just like on 4 Telegram messages
yeah.
and on a Google Meet, and actually thinking about their community, actually spending time with the community. And then I think the final thing is that people are passionate. You know, like I know a lot of people that have, you know, have very successful jobs. They like them. They work there four day week. And that's that. Whereas people in Web3, they have figured an idea.
Yeah.
And they do want to bring it to market, not just because they're like, I have to, they want to.
I agree. I think it's one of the most unique things about blockchain events is that, like, we do a lot of ad tech events and it's like B2B only. It's people that work for a company that are there to meet people to do a deal. But like, you go to a Web3 event and sure, there is some of that, right? There are people there that are looking to meet people to do a deal. But equally, there's just people that are interested in the technology that aren't fortunate enough to do it full time, because I think it is an amazing place to work and awesome to work at the cusp of emerging technology is a great place to be. But some people just don't get to talk to any of their friends about it or don't know any other people in it. So like, they come to these events and people are just like excited to talk to other people that they don't have to explain blockchain to. Do you know what I mean? Like, you get through that. Oh, it does this, and then that's this, and this is why it's cool, and that's why it's cool. Yeah. Because I sometimes talk to people like, "What? Like, how's it going at work?" And it's like, this is only really going one way, because like, you're not going to understand anything that I tell you, and I'm then going to be unengaged in the conversation, and you're going to think I'm a bit of an idiot because I'm not giving you the TLDR on what I'm doing. But it's like, fundamentally, you do not even have like the level of information you need at table stakes for me to be in this very self-reflective, but for me to really enjoy this conversation with you. So like, that's why blockchain events are great, because you can just get part of, like, okay, everyone knows what Solana is at Zebu Live in September, right? 99 out of the 100 people that show up will know exactly what it is. Then you can have a cool conversation about how you use Solana for an RWA and how stuff that's going on Ethereum is kind of allowing it to compete at the speed of transactions that Solana is seeing. Like, they're the cool conversations that advance technology forwards and not,
yeah,
that's necessarily the people that haven't been pilled yet. Like, don't get me wrong, I'll try and pill people all the time, but like, it's nice to speak to people that have taken the same pill as you, you know?
Yeah, definitely. And I think that is such a good point that taking people from naught to one,
it's tough after a while once
we do it. And I think there's so much opportunity out here, you know. Like, I'm very excited to try and get, you know, I'm working towards an alchemy node. You know, PayPal's giving 20% on USDC at the moment.
Really?
That is just like, you know, and there's so much sort of, if you know what, because even for me, who spends all, you know, I still can't believe I'm paid to chat to the founders of these projects.
Yeah.
You know, if I wasn't paid to do this, I'd be sitting on Reddit or watching YouTube and trying to understand what's going on, and you know, talking to these amazing founders and projects and foundations, and you know, spending a lot of time talking to Ton at the moment, who build Telegram, which I'm just so bullish on. You know, 900 million users, not a mention of Web3, sneaking, putting a wallet in there. But it's like, even for me, when I get back to my Twitter or I'm reading my news and I've got all these tokens and NFTs, etc., I'm confused. Can I trust this staking platform? You know, everyone got burnt in Anchor quite badly when that went down. Like, even for me, I'm like, do I want to risk putting my ETH into this smart contract? And so actually, if you do start to, if you can speak to people that are on your level, they're like, wow, yeah, this is actually, I know this guy. I mean, always do your own research, and you can start to get these amazing yield farming.
Agree.
And so I think that sort of like collective growth. But I do think we do have to be kind on ourselves, because everyone wants everything all the time. Our community are watching the charts. They're like, so many projects have raised a lot of money. And, you know, have not done, you know, and I've been watching the incredible growth of the publishers on Alchemy, and it's just like
it's been pretty good recently.
Every time I'm, and that's as a community member, and an investor and a holder, that makes me really excited to see those updates. But certain projects take a lot longer to build. And then also we look at some projects that raised 100, 200, 300 million. They haven't really built anything.
Yeah, no, I agree.
And so I think there is that sort of communities can be quite untrusting if they're not getting those updates. And
yeah, and I think that's something that we're very fortunate to have the community that we have, because it's like that virtually everyone has taken the time to understand programmatic marketing and advertising, which is like super niche. Like, it's people get exposed to it all the time because you go on the internet and you see an ad. People don't realize that is literally like the MPU on top of the tip of the iceberg. Yeah. With really everything that's going on underneath it. And I think that is cool that people do that and take the time to learn. And then what I spend all my time doing really is like, I spend a lot of time following certain accounts on Twitter, like understanding the advancements that are made in DeFi. And it's like, okay, well, how can you translate that into something that might make sense for a digital advertising market, which is very similar, parts of it are very similar to the way that financial markets are traded, but loads of it, pieces of it aren't. And like, okay, you can take this part of it and that could be translated into this part, you know, like, and that then can help bring more of these dollars on chain. And then you get to a point where you have like dollars that are spent by advertisers are on chain, then you have this new pool of liquidity that you could borrow from, that you could lend to, you know,
yeah,
that like allows you to then earn a yield like such from the liquidity, but also from running a validator to support the network or just pooling it on balance. You know, there's tons of ways that you could, well, you couldn't, pardon me, in the past, unless you created an ad tech company, get access to this market. And that is what tokenization does. It's just like flatten the playing field a little bit more. You provide some value, you get some value back, and like you can create, we talk about like it's this intangible real RWA, right? Like it's billions and billions and billions and billions of ad units exist.
Yeah.
And if you can be the protocol that validates that ad unit, there's a yield that can be generated. And like, that is the game, right? Like, how do we get high volume of transactions to get a ton of flow, to create yield, to then allow all of these amazing derivative products purely just from using a blockchain to make capital more efficient.
Yeah.
From the advertiser to the seller. And then it's like, okay, then all of these other cool things open up outside of, at the moment, the innovation is like your advertisers here, your publishers here, all the innovation stuck here.
Yeah.
It needs to be outside here because there's way more space.
Yeah.
To do loads of really cool shit on the outside of the transaction than there is on the inside of the transaction. Like, look at the London Stock Exchange, right? Like, used to be 80% of its revenue from fees.
Yeah.
Now it's like 2%, and all the revenue comes from data to provide insights, to give people an edge, to make a trade, to make some money. You know, like, that's what we want to do, is like make it more akin to that kind of marketplace where you have the efficient movement of capital between the buyer and the seller of an asset, and your innovations added at the edges. That's like just turning it inside out, basically, is the game here.
Wow. How long do you think that process is going to take? And
3 years so far. I think it's...
it's a big goal, isn't it? That's not I want to do on-chain perps.
No. It's... well, I think we're in a very fortunate position in that we get to play a role, and like quite a major role, in defining what decentralized advertising looks like. You know,
amazing.
like, and you can learn from the past, you can learn from financial markets, but then there's stuff that you can do with DeFi or NFTs or distributed ledgers or distributed networks of validators that you can't necessarily do there. So it's like, how do you marry those two bits together to create a nice solution? And then how do you say, okay, it's wrapped up in a nice box, here you go, person with that problem, here's a solution to that problem.
Yeah, because that's a good point, because I've dealt with, like, back to one of your previous points, the reason why we hang out in what we call is Web 3 is we got fed up of trying to talk to Web 2 people who are like, ignore email.
Yeah.
And when I go back to my music festival days, all of those, sort of when I left that industry, all of those music people are slowly warming up to Web 3 and understanding. Mm-hmm. And how would you say the sort of Web 2... Is it because advertising technology is more techie that they're more open to, like, are the Web 2 people being like, wow, this sounds interesting, let's play around with it? Or are they like, are they interested?
So,
or is it an uphill battle?
It's, yes, it can be for sure, but sometimes it's not. So there was a report that came out a couple of years ago, two reports, in fact, that looked at the supply path. And by the supply path, I mean the path of a dollar from an advertiser through to where that ad is being shown eventually. And there's this notion of supply path optimization. So understanding who's taking fees, for what reason, how much are those fees, and what impact does that have on the overall performance or revenue that's being generated from that ad. It's difficult as it stands to optimize a supply path with centralized infrastructure, because you have a scenario where, like, there's, let's say there's four people that sit between someone buying an ad and someone selling the ad space. These people run the process and they spit out an API that allows you to call it. And then these people run the process and these people run the process and these people run the process. So you have like discrepancies across the board. You have space for margin to be added in that scenario. And it's also expensive to retrieve that data from a centralized server. A distributed ledger, however, like your process that was running here to get your report and your process that was running here to get your report, doesn't happen anymore. Everyone, like, I run part of the transaction and then I write it to a public record. I run part of the transaction and I write it to a public record. So when you want to query something in the same way that you see this with Etherscan, which public record of everything that's happened on Ethereum, and companies like Nansen and Arkham are able to provide insights and intelligence from a public ledger, you now know that the supply path, that what happened is what happened. There's no, you can't argue with it. You then just provide insights on top of that platform. And that is really all that brands want to know, is like, how is my dollar being spent? How can I make that capital more efficient? Who are the right partners to work with to do that? So when you kind of break it down in the way that I have just done there, they're like, oh, it's make, why wouldn't I use a blockchain for it? And it's when people get that, they're like, hey, this is the way to do it. You know, like that. Yeah. We've had a few people that have done that. So like IPG are really hot on this. We had a really great podcast with Magna, with Flaminia from Magna. She's like, this is a way to optimize your supply path. And that is just key, because the cost of, like, if you think, like, if your cost of acquisition for your customer goes up, you have to charge people more money for your product. On top of everything else costing more money, like labor costing more money, goods costing more money, marketing costing more money, inflation in general, like the cost of your good goes up. So if you can be a brand that can optimize that and like reduce the cost of your goods because your customer acquisition costs go down, you're going to have an advantage versus everyone else in the market, because you have this amazing product that is cheaper than the next product that might be more amazing or less amazing, but you can win at a price point that still delivers the margin that you need as a business to operate. So it's like becoming a big deal.
Amazing. And it's some big names you mentioned there. I mean, one thing that I'm really excited about is zero knowledge proofs. You know, that's, if we think about, you obviously mentioned with Etherscan, if I'm Vodafone, I don't want you to go on my blockchain and I don't want you to be able to see my phone number and like a record of all of my, all of my, whatever my calls are, where it's stored. And, you know, the concept of zero knowledge proofs, allowing people not to have to build a private blockchain, but to store all of this on chain. And the fact that, like, if we think of like in a car rental situation, I mean, you probably rented a car. It's the worst experience ever, isn't it? Like, here's my passport, here's my driving license, here's my credit card, here's my other credit card.
Yeah, it's my blood type. And how much I weigh.
And now suddenly with zero knowledge proofs, I can go, I'm over 18, I have a credit card, and this is my address, and I can just send you that. And you don't store that data. So that's quite an interesting point for big brands to sort of...
100%. Like, if you think about... the misuse of data by platforms for targeting ads. Like, there's some platforms that perhaps have been targeting children when they shouldn't have done, or if you're an alcohol brand and you want to be able to target people that are over 25, or like gambling brands, you know, like there's a whole group of legislation in Europe called GDPR. You have the CCPA in California, which is around protecting people's data online, and people are being fined for breaking those rules. And it's like, as you say, a zero knowledge proof is a really nice way for someone to know, in an advertising context, it's like, okay, I want to target people that are aged 18 to 24, that like sport, that go to the gym three times a week, because I'm Gymshark. you don't want to know that that's Harry or Ben. You just want to know that that person sits within your target audience, so you know you're not wasting money
showing
that message. And I think like that is where knowing someone sits within a cohort of people that's valuable to you is much better than knowing that person and that person and that person and their postcodes. And do you know what I mean? You need to know that. You need to know that they're in it and verify that they're in it so you don't waste money.
That's a really great example and exactly what I was thinking.
Yeah.
It's, you know, because, you know, we kind of do like our targeted ads, don't we?
Yeah, they're good, you know?
You know, it's nice. If you are a 24-year-old gym goer, you don't want to hear about, you know, care homes in...
waste of money.
You know, so, and is that something that you guys can you reward back the users? You know, because there's always been this sort of, you know, I think people don't like Facebook in a sense because they know how much we're making them content and we're using their content and we know the advertising. There's never been that share unless you're like an influencer.
Yeah.
Do you think we will get to a point where we can sort of opt in there, or you think that's
it's a good question. And I think to like unpack the Facebook point, like they were providing a service that was really like fun to use, you know, which was like you could speak to all your friends and you could organize events and you knew when everyone's birthday was and you could share memes and so on through their platform. Like that was a good enough trade-off for them effectively selling your data to advertisers to fund it. And now I think that unfortunately, you, for like what advertisers are prepared to pay for an ad, let's say it's like $5 to run video ads, but they're bought in bales of 1,000. So like you and I would have to sit here and watch 1,000 videos each to get $5. And now that's probably not worth it for us. It certainly isn't worth it for a brand because they've shown the same ad to someone 1,000 times. They're probably going to be sick of your product by the time they've done that, and then you've wasted that money showing it to the same person. And actually there's frequency caps, you can't do that. You can only see an ad 5 times in 24 hours. Where it might become interesting for us as internet users again is that, because, and using our community example here, we have a really low fee. So a website or an app or a connected TV, whatever digital channel it is that we can run an ad on, gets more value for the ads that they show. There'll be fewer ads, so then the overall user experience might be more enjoyable than it is right now. So like there's more of an incentive for you to come back to your platform. I'm not saying you couldn't say, right, okay, if you come back to the FT every day, you get a streak, and if you get to 7 days in a row, you get to come to their event where you get to speak to an investor or whatever it is, right? Those incentive mechanisms are possible. I just think there will be some trade-off in terms of like user experience or advancements to the products or whatever it is that's facilitated by a blockchain delivering more value to people that create content than there has been right now.
Yeah, I mean, that's an amazing point. And I think one of the things, you know, it's quite a technical product.
Oh, yeah.
That you're building. And, you know, I've invested in probably 300 different projects and I've probably worked on 100 projects and quite a close advisor on quite a few. And one of the things that people always talk to me about and ask me about is like, I want to build a community.
Mm.
And, you know, following your community online, for such a technical product in a bear market, I've just seen, you know, I'm seeing the Discord, it's such an engaged community and it feels really authentic. I'm not just seeing, you know, generic bot post, but I'm seeing so much conversation and you know the passion as the publishers are going up. Like what do you think the importance of community is, and what were the key points for you building your community and making it so active?
I think from like the very beginning, because when we launched the token in 2021, so it was like, at that point, there was a lot of scams. There was a lot of founders that weren't doxed. You didn't know who they were. And I think like Chorley, Chandra and I had all worked in advertising. And like the issues that we want to solve with Alchemy are issues that I faced acutely in my day job before we launched Alchemy. So like we came to it wanting to solve a problem. to run a decentralized network, you need a group of independent validators to allow for the cost savings on the infrastructure. Like, that's what a blockchain facilitates. If it was just us doing it all, it would be a centralized network. We'd be no different to anyone else, right? So, like, they are essential. The community is essential to creating a network that fundamentally can guarantee the future of the ad-funded internet, which is the best future, which is the best version of the internet, right? Like, no paywalls, walled gardens, kind of choose the content that you get to see. But really, if you put more money back into journalists and content writers and developers at these publications, that will get better. There'll be more content available. It'll be kind of more like it used to be, a bit flatter, be less alienating for certain people if you don't agree with something. Do you know what I mean? It just, like, yeah. The reason I think a lot of that has happened is because people are so desperate to fight for dollars that you have to write something that is clickbaity, a bit salacious, yeah, or clickbaity, right? To kind of get people onto your article so they see an ad so you get paid. But if you get more money for that ad, if you make the capital more efficient, that's literally all we're saying, you make the capital more efficient to the people that are creating value, everything just becomes a bit more efficient, you know, from, yeah, like quantitatively, qualitatively. When capital moves more freely in a predator market, it becomes just better, you know.
And what is more efficient to you? Like, are you talking about like 2%, or are you talking like 50%?
In terms of like what we're able to deliver back?
No, but you know, you're talking about the capital moving efficiently, and yes, you know, you're making more. Is it a seismic shift?
Yeah, massive. So like in that ISBA report I was referencing earlier, the average fee, and this is like under a microscope when someone's checking what your fees are, was 47%. So like, wow, that's 47 cents of every dollar just disappears to people that want to make a margin, right? So like, we're at 3-8%. So like, wow, 10 times cheaper, because we've seen in some of the campaigns that we've run, those numbers are way higher. We were like, for one campaign we did in particular, it was 212% cheaper to buy through our rails.
Wow.
Versus Web2 rails. And that's because you had like three or four partners that were paid taking like 70-80% each. Because the other big thing in this study was that they started off looking at 1.6 billion ad impressions. They could only match 63 million impressions from end to end.
Wow.
Which meant that then they had, and then of those 63 million, the fees were 47%. Now, I'm sure there's a lot of skeletons that hide in those billions of impressions that weren't seen. And
yeah,
we're starting to see that with the test that we're running. So like, an advertiser's starting to see that. We're getting like repeat bookings from big clients that are increasing in size quite like dramatically, because they're seeing better capital efficiency for the money they're spending on advertising in terms of like the performance. Like we ran a campaign recently for Currys, which is like, wow, the consumer electric company. We deliver close to 6 times ROAS, so return on their ad spend.
Wow.
So like, that's
amazing.
Yeah,
I used to try and get 2 or 3 sometimes.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. And that was for a campaign land. So what they were targeting was people landing on the Currys website, and we delivered 6 times ROAS. So it's like,
wow.
But it makes sense. You take the margin out of things, stuff moves much quicker, you know?
Definitely. Like
that is the game, right?
No, and I think that's the problem we have as a marketing agency, isn't it? Like, it's that you need to work with people that are spending enough.
Yeah, sure.
You know that our time is expensive, mm-hmm, and non-scalable.
Yeah.
You know, if we're working on one project, we can't work on another project. And actually, having people spend enough to actually make a change and to get these tests where, mm-hmm, you can... Because the secret to marketing is very, very simple. Work out which of the 50% works, yeah, and scale, totally, it.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
right.
And
yeah,
it's like, you know, people often come to me and go, oh, I don't know, Discord. Should I be on Discord? Mm. Oh, should I be on Telegram? Or should I be on Twitter? And it's like, my honest answer is, it doesn't really matter where you are. And, you know, in your example, it doesn't really matter where these ads go.
Yeah.
It's, are they getting me a ROAS? Are they working? Can I go back to Mr. CEO? Or, you know, finance guys love to look at what marketing,
yeah,
people are doing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You spend what?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
And so if we can get that data, I think it will allow people to spend with more confidence. I guess you mentioned a lot of big Web2 brands,
yeah,
that are sort of testing it. Would you say you're more focused on just like the purely like, you know, using Web3 for the Web2 end users, which is quite a cool concept?
Yeah, I think
Or do you have like Web3 customers as well?
So we're starting now to speak to more Web3 people and customers. So like big exchanges for their user acquisition strategy. But that's still for me quite DR. So like there's also some foundations we're speaking to as well about kind of, and that they're slightly different. They're educating people on their product, which is like cooler part of the funnel, in my opinion. It's like, how do you go from here to here? Not just like, how do I convert people to here straight away? I don't really, I don't want to sound facetious, care what type of brand it is. What I want to be able to do is deliver more media for your money using blockchain rails. Like that is it. Like I would work with Coinbase, I would work with Tesco's, you know, like I don't really mind. I'd want to deliver a more efficient means of allowing you to find your users where you need to find them. You know, like that is it, really. That's the amazing tweet. And it's like, yes, we use a blockchain. Yes, it allows us to do the things that we do. But ultimately, I just want to facilitate the ability for people to buy ads in a more efficient way. You know, to like that. That's it. It doesn't.
Amazing.
Like, I think it was Peter Thiel that said this, but it's, or maybe it's not. But anyway, it's like technology like is really working when it feels like magic and you don't really understand how it's working. It just like works how you want it to work. And you're like Google Meets. It's just like you do two clicks, you can speak to someone anywhere, you know, like that. And it's just 80% as good as a conversation in real life. You know, like that is pretty cool.
And is that what Facebook kind of fixed for us? You know, I was quite an early, I was an early growth hacker on Facebook. So I used to get millions, like branded, not cat videos. I could get branded content and I could go all my events, you know, everyone came from all over the country to Exeter. They were all tagged obviously Zuck killed the algo in about, you know, 2012 and he brought in advertising. And I was, you know, and I spent a lot of time doing that kind of, you know, Facebook advertising. That was almost the first time.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I mean, we still struggle to use Twitter for adverts.
Yeah.
You know, no one is there. I don't know many people. Lots of people.
Format, I think.
Lots of people make ads on Twitter because they've maxed out their spend on every other platform. They're like, well, we'll give it a try. But I think maybe the sort of ads around the internet got a bit of a bad rep. And
totally,
you know, we do it, but we... I mean, it's quite top of funnel because I do quite a lot of stuff on Dex Screener and, you know, taking those top banners at the top. I have no idea if it works. Mm. I kind of think it works.
Yeah, I think so.
It's been involved in successful campaigns.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's that sort of dashboard and that easy to use. Mm-hmm. Do you envision that sort of channel becoming a lot bigger again?
I think so, yeah. As you get more people that... This was a while ago now, but I spoke to a chap that was running a blockchain website, and this was February, so a long time ago, but that February was his biggest ever month for traffic. Yep. So like, and that is just generally indicative of a growing interest in blockchain. So like, as it attracts more eyeballs, people will want to spend money there because there's more eyeballs there. You know, that is simple as that. You go where people are if you're trying to sell people things.
Which is presumably why crypto.com have gone for the Champions League.
Exactly. It's why ads and Piccadilly Circus still work, because millions of people go through Piccadilly Circus every day. Like, there's virtually zero attribution for a billboard at Piccadilly Circus.
Yeah.
But those ads work.
We sometimes made... because... In the early stages of like Web3 marketing, I built up a formula.
Yeah.
And I would love to track it like we do it in Web2, you know, Facebook ads. But it's just kind of working. And you know, like sometimes trying to be too granular on it, it's like, because KOLs are very hard to track.
Yeah,
very hard. You know, hard, like KOL posts, if you're putting like referral links in them, almost are taking away from the post and the whole message.
And I think it's probably unfair to say it's hard. It's not the KOLs, it's the platforms, right? Like, if you imagine that Meta gave you this suite of analytics that they go out and offer to their buyers, no one, it's not fair, but fewer people would go directly to Meta to buy ad campaigns than they do right now, because they're like... You like the KOL is like the conduit to some of the insights that you get from Meta or Twitter, but Meta is the conduit to tell you exactly what you got for what you spent.
Yeah.
and they make tons of money from doing that. So they're not going to like, sorry, you can't see all these things because we're selling them to these guys. Like, I know you want to sell them to them too, but unlucky, we create the platform. So like it's part of their like advantage as a business that did it. And they had a ton of scale. They had device IDs, which is a great identifier. And they were able to give people really tight attribution models. It's the same reason the App Store does so well, because they have device IDs, you pay them, spend money to go with Apple marketing, you can get really tight campaign performance.
Although the App Store is a bit of a pain for for Web3 and DeFi and that 30% fee. And you mentioned, obviously, when we teamed up with Stephen Bartlett, so we were Zebu, and then we teamed up to be Flight 3, which is part of Flight Story.
Yeah.
Because similar to you, I see a switch where these big brands are going to sort of, you know, like we started it as a fully Web3 company because we want to be in Web3 and we wanted to test and move quickly. But surely soon, and we've seen it with Sony and Samsung and all these big brands launching Web3, MasterCard, PayPal, you know, they're all doing it now. And like one of the cool things about being a wider network group is like we're getting ready for that. And you know, one of the big things I'm really excited about is London Web3 Week. Yeah. And you know, London's had a tricky time with Web3.
Yeah.
And those people that know me know that I'm a big advocate. I've been running community events in London for 10 years. And I'm a bit sad by the state of where we've gone. You know, we had Rishi promising a crypto state. We're falling behind Switzerland, Portugal, Dubai, even Singapore, you know. And so London Web3 Week, and it's a big moment for us to, you know, we've got some people from the government coming. Mm-hmm. We've got big brands coming. We've got Web3 people coming. We've got banks coming. Mm-hmm. We've got advocates coming. And so that's going to be a really exciting time where everyone can go like, oh wow, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. Let's connect.
Yeah, I think it's part of me thinks it's like British people are a bit reserved in general. Do you know what I mean? Like I think it's like that's where we're fundamentally different to like America, let's say. But I think you're right. I think the UK is positioned in the world really nicely in terms of time zones. So you can deal with everyone around the world, which is great. It's why we had like a massive financial services sector, and that like blockchain isn't too dissimilar to that. Like you can provide a ton of services to a ton of people using a blockchain. So we are like geographically positioned perfectly. Linguistically, we're fortunate enough to speak English, which everyone speaks English, you know? So like there's no reason why we shouldn't lead the world effectively in the same way that America has done and then has been curtailed a bit. But like, yeah, why not? I'd love to see it. It'd make life way easier.
Yeah, definitely. And I think if you look at our capital, our funding, our, as you say, our time zone. So yeah, you know, maybe you can share a discount code or some free tickets with
absolutely. Yeah, we're going to be there
with the viewers. But you know, I've got a mad week. I'm excited for it. It's like probably one of the. Obviously, it's not the biggest show in terms of like pure people compared to a music festival, but like, so we've got a big event on the Monday. Mm-hmm. We've got lots of different side events and a sort of warehouse on the Tuesday.
Yeah.
Wednesday, we're taking over Shoreditch House for like a VIP dinner. Thursday, we're going Woolwich Works, which is our like fireworks factory.
Yeah.
Can hold 3,500 people. And then we've got Token Tracks doing like live music. There's a comedy brand. And then we're back on the Friday. And loads of talks and stuff, and then we go to London East with a party organizer called Bash, who's putting. We got like a guy shooting everything on VHS.
Oh, nice!
And then so it's gonna be a really really exciting week. And
yeah, certainly.
Looking through the list of people, you know, because Zebu Live basically means like one of the things about the brand that I'm building is that if I called it NFT NYC, suddenly that's out of date, you know, and the whole thing about Zebu Live is it means the future of tech.
Yeah.
And like, you know, this year what's quite hot is L2s, real world assets, DeepIn, you know, all of next year there'll be a different set of terms. And so we're quite excited to see what you're doing and really excited to have you there.
Yeah, so I think I'm going to do a keynote. We'll have a panel with a really exciting guest. We're going to be inviting a lot of the people that have used our exchange to kind of expose them to Web3 for the first time, and I've been saying it now on a few podcasts, but yeah, if anyone wants to come along, we can share a code, and I'd love to meet you all in person, and we can meet Harry. We'll be running around like headless chickens, talking to everyone. But Harry, I think we could probably talk for the next 5 hours. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on. You're welcome back anytime.
Awesome.
And maybe the next time we'll get your brother on and Millie can join us, and we'll have like a sibling versus sibling crypto podcast. So yeah,
I'm up for that.
Nice. All right. Thank you very much, mate. Appreciate that.